this is the document you should have received. Did you not get this one?
I didn't get it with highlights, underlining.
Oh.
And so it's just difficult to review because, you know, those were sort of mixed in there.
I'm sorry. That should this is the version that should have gone out to you.
It says that actually it does say draft advisory committee charter version 8/12/20.
Okay. My apologies if you received received the incorrect one. This is the one that should have gone out to you with track changes. And so that does make it difficult for you to review in advance. I hope going through it step by step now is good enough for our discussion. And thank you for pointing that out, Anne.
Real quick, it may be that just the view that you're on in Word maybe is hiding the track changes. That's possible. If you go up to the review tab.
I don't have Word. I'm using Apple products.
Okay. Just a thought there.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have the option of changing that to my knowledge.
I see. Well, we could also just make sure we send it out as a PDF, and then you would see the changes, right? Sometimes they go out in Word so that you could add track changes if you want yourself. But okay, that's an important note for ease of review. Thanks for pointing that out, Anne. And let me ask the SHAC members. Do you have any suggested, does anyone want to discuss anything else related to the charter before I ask you to weigh in with your nonverbal cues about approving these modifications? And let's go to George first.
Just a point of order before we vote, every time the public should have a chance to weigh in.
Thank you very much for the reminder, George. You're a little garbled there, but we'll just keep an eye on that audio, okay? Great, so I don't see anything else from SHAC members. Members of the public, please raise your hand or go off mute if you are on the phone, letting us know if you have any suggested, if you have any questions of the SHAC about their charter. Okay, seeing none. SHAC members, please go ahead and Gary, I see your hands gone up.
The last section, the amendments comment.
Okay, let me go to it.
Last page.
Mm-hmm.
Would you clarify, SHAC can recommend future changes to the charter, blah, blah, blah. And is there a shutoff date on this, or does this continue basically forever?
There is no shutoff date. That's why there is an amendment clause. So if something were to come up where any SHAC member or a board member from the VINA GSA wants to revisit the charter, that can happen at any time. And we would go through a similar process that we have thus far with the modifications. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, SHAC members. I'm going to ask you to use your nonverbal cues, the yes and no. Do you approve these modifications to your charter? Thank you, Anne, Bruce, Cherie, Chris, Gary, George, Greg, Samantha. Did I miss any SHAC members? Okay, and let me just to put a fine point on this. once we go ahead and accept the modifications that you see and track changes here, we will send this these modifications to the VINA GSA board for their consideration. As you see here, they are ultimately the ones who approve any recommendation you make, including recommendations to your charter. So let me clear your nonverbal cues, and to just put a fine point on this, does the SHAC approve the revised modified version of the SHAC charter going to the VINA GSA board for their consideration? Yes or no? Is it ready to go to the board? Thank you, Anne, Bruce, Cherie, Chris, Gary, George, Samantha. I'm not seeing your vote on this. Thank you, Samantha. Did I miss any SHAC members? Okay, excellent. Thank you, SHAC. We will accept these modifications, and we will send it on over to the VINA GSA board. I'm taking a look at, I'm glad to see that we're a little bit ahead of schedule so we can spend more time on the draft basin setting discussions and other items. So I would like to hand it over to you, Christina. I've stopped screen share so that you can share your screen to discuss the draft basin setting GSP chapters.
It looks like I'm just a participant though, so I can't share.
Oh, thank you. We will make you the co-host.
Okie dokie.
Thanks for the reminder. And everyone, this is being recorded. SHAC meetings are recorded. Just wanted to make sure that we communicated that to you. Okay, Christina.
Okay, there we go. Okay. Okay, how's that?
Perfect.
Can you see it? Okay. Let me fix one more thing. Okay, so good morning. Thank you for the opportunity here. I think we'll have a great discussion about these documents. I wanted to do a little less overview, perhaps, because there was the technical webinar that went into all the details of the content that was going to be coming out as part of this chapter, the basin setting chapter. And then we had an overview of that back at the SHAC. I believe that was in June, I guess. And so today, I'll give a quick overview, but I think you're probably mostly familiar with what's in these documents. And so I wanted to really just highlight a couple of things that were in the draft document that was kind of new to the draft from the material that had been presented in the past. And I think there are a couple important pieces there. And then open it up for just questions, and I'll give kind of highlights from the comments that were received also, and that was in the attached staff report. And then we can talk about just any questions you have on the drafts or on the comments. And then I guess we'll take a break. We'll see kind of where we're at, and we can move into a conversation around recommendations as well. So you've seen this slide probably a number of times now, just orienting ourselves to what content there is in the whole GSP. And this project, the Basin Setting Project, carved off the Basin Setting chapter and a portion of the Monitoring Network chapter. So this is what you saw in these drafts: description of hydrogeologic conceptual model, the groundwater conditions, the water budget, and management areas are still to come, although that I believe has been drafted. And then the beginnings of the Monitoring Network, mostly this first piece in terms of, you know, describing what the existing Monitoring Network is, and then there will be more to come on selecting representative monitoring out of that for sustainable management criteria development, and more information on improving improving the monitoring network moving forward. So I did want to kind of side note here. You may have noticed that groundwater dependent ecosystems and description of those, identification of groundwater dependent ecosystems, was not in the draft basin setting document. And that is where it will first appear in the groundwater sustainability plan. So I wanted to give you a update here from Kelly. She'll give us an update. Actually, work is underway and it will end up in this document, but it's not quite there yet. Kelly, you want to describe what's been done so far and where it's headed?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so just a real quick, I'm going to try to sum this up in just a couple minutes or so. Groundwater dependent ecosystems are basically ecosystems which reach down and are dependent on groundwater. So that can include rivers, streams, riparian vegetation, seeps, wetlands, those types of things. They're considered in SGMA in a few different areas of the law, and they're really an environmental beneficial user of groundwater. So they need to be considered within every GSP, and that can be a little tricky to figure out sometimes because being dependent on groundwater includes seasonal and annual fluctuations of groundwater. So the first step really, and it could also be a little more complex if you're looking at these ecosystems that are near surface waters and interconnected waters, and those that are even farther away from those. So the first question in all of this is really understanding where they're located. That was that's the biggest step that we've been looking at. So to do that, TNC, DWR, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have put together a database, which is basically a web mapping application of specific polygons throughout all of the subbasins, and they're calling those, you know, potential GDEs. So we looked at that, and really it's on the GSAs to then do local verification and really look at those and assess whether or not they are groundwater dependent. And so there's a series of steps and criteria that you can apply to each one of these polygons to help understand that. So we started doing that back in fall of 2019 with most of our GSA managers from all three sub-basins. We took a look and reviewed the potential GDEs within each of their areas, answered a series of questions to verify whether or not, you know, they thought they were or they weren't sure. And so there was a big effort underway with that, with workshops, again in spring of 2020, that happened again. And in addition, a GDE working group was formed with a few of the SHAC members here, some of our management committee, some professors from Chico State University, DWR staff, and also representatives from the Butte Environmental Council. To get feedback on our approach on how we've been analyzing these and moving these forward. So that's still underway. We're still in that process of identifying them and packaging that up to really just move over to the geosyntech team and the consultant team to work on the next steps with that, which would be, you know, after we identify which ones we think are or are not. Today would be using those in upcoming discussions with the SHAC for sustainable management criteria and how the criteria that is set will be protective of those areas. And I'm way over 2 minutes, so I'm gonna stop here.
No, that's great. Yeah.
I'd like to just pause there, Christina, if we could, to see if any SHAC members have questions about where you are with GDEs or where the process is. And then I see, it looks, Jim Brobeck, it looks like you've joined. Just want to mention that. I'm not sure if you have audio though. You can go ahead and chat us, Jim, to let us know if you're here and able to have audio. Okay, Christina, go ahead. Thank you very much.
It looks like Sheree just raised her hand, actually. Sheree, did you want to ask a question?
I did, thank you. And thank you for that. I was just wondering, and you can send this offline, but I was wondering if you can share the Chico State faculty who were assisting with that process. I'd like to connect with them.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yes, we have Ms. Colleen Hatfield from Environmental Sciences, as well as Mr. Jeff Davids, hydrogeologist from Chico State as well.
Perfect, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, so this is a topic that when those, that will come back to you for kind of more specific update and some of the maps and that have been put together. So stay tuned for more details on the GDEs.
Christina, Bruce is asking a question via chat. Sure. Is the GDE group going to use WebEx?
I know we had some technical difficulties with that. We will keep you posted. We are, you know, finding that folks are most familiar with Zoom. So we will switch over if we can, but I think mostly the work of the GDE working group is done at this point, and I think you'll probably see the products come to the Shack with some updates, maybe via email to that working group on how things are coming together. Hopefully that answers your question. We'll use Zoom if we can. I think that it's more familiar to folks. Okay, so switching gears a little bit, I wanted to highlight one of the things that's in the hydrogeologic conceptual model portion of the GSP document, of the basin setting document, and that was related to some of the results from the Airborne Electromagnetic Survey, or the AEM survey. So some of you are familiar with this project, partnered with Glenn County, because some of this data was collected in Glenn County, and then also Stanford DWR State Board provided some funding, and then local Butte County funding as well to collect this data. So helicopter flew these flight lines that you see on the map, basically going back and forth, both in the eastern area, trying to better understand kind of what things look like as the valley moves into the foothill region over there, the lower foothills. And then on the west side, you know, toward the center of the valley where we know the Tuscan Formation kind of comes together with the Tehama Formation, and wanting to better understand what the big picture structure of the aquifer system looks like over there. So I just wanted to highlight, these are a couple bullet point questions that I pulled off of the AEM project website from our department website. And what were some of the things that we were really hoping to learn from this data set? And a lot of them delineating major aquifer and aquitard units to improve hydrogeologic conceptual model, right? So we're hoping that this is gonna refine our kind of conceptual understanding of our aquifer system. Assess spatial distribution of clay layers, how extensive are they? And really trying to get at, you know, we talk a lot about shallow zone, deeper zone, shallow aquifer, deep aquifer, pressurized zones. One of the questions was, what's the extent of these clay layers? How does that affect, you know, vertical conductivity and connectivity? And so therefore also examining the level of connectivity between upper and lower portions of the Tehama and Tuscan aquifer system, and then identifying kind of big picture structure of the aquifer system. And that could be used to improve our groundwater modeling tools in the long run. So those are some of our original questions. And I wanted to pause here for a minute and just talk a little bit about some groundwater terms. And I know this is maybe a lot of groundwater jargon here, but I think it's important to start to get familiar with some of these things and for us to be, as we move into trying to manage the system and making decisions around thresholds and sustainable criteria and monitoring different portions of the system to maybe have some common language. So I want to make the distinction between kind of stratigraphic units, and those are made up of kind of the building blocks of geologic formations and the geology, which in the basin setting document, kind of three primary stratigraphic units or geologic formations are described. The quaternary deposits, which are the shallow deposits laid down by more recent, relatively geologically more recent rivers and streams that are in the Sac Valley, and then the Tuscan Formation and the Tehama Formation. And here's just a snapshot of a portion of a DWR cross-section that used well data to understand kind of these layerings of these geologic formations. And so when you look at this, this is a cross-section that goes from, here's the Chico Monocline over here in the east, and it goes over to the Sacramento River. I just kind of snapped that piece out of it. So you can see that, you know, a big chunk of the aquifer system that we're talking about is Tuscan Formation. But then we kind of want to switch gears to some degree in really thinking about our aquifer system as made up of different types of sediment types, right? Generally two big buckets. Coarse grain material, that's your gravels and sands, right? That's what water moves through well, and those are your aquifer materials. So coarse grained versus fine grained, which are your muds, silt, clay. Water doesn't move through those very well. They can hold a lot of water, right? Clay holds a lot of water, but it doesn't drain very well. So those are not aquifer materials. If you want to get really jargony, it's an aquitard, right? Because things move through it, water moves through slowly. But those are your fine grained sediments. So those are kind of your two, in really big picture view, your two building blocks of your aquifer system. And those are interlayered and have different kind of patterns, right, within the subsurface, within the groundwater system. So you can see from this cross-section, and this is just pulled out of the Lower Tuscan Aquifer study that was finished back in 2013. Just as an example, this figure is also a cross-section. It's between two wells, but it shows both kind of in the background, the geologic formation, Tuscan Unit A here, Tuscan Unit B, C, D, and the quaternary deposits on top. But then kind of in front of that are also included is the sediment type or the sediment texture of the material that's making up those formation units. And that's here in this section down at the bottom is sand and gravel. And then we have fine grained mudstone, sandstone, so, you know, some layers of gravel and sands in the middle, a thin layer here of sand and gravel that's kind of sandwiched between fine grained. So I think we just want to be beginning to make the distinction between the Tuscan Formation as a geologic stratigraphic unit and our aquifer materials and characteristics of the material that makes up these aquifer systems that are being, you know, tapped by wells for domestic users and agricultural users, and, you know, the nature of the shallower zone that's interacting with streams and creeks and potentially supporting groundwater dependent ecosystems. So with that kind of just background, this is part of the figure that was included in the basin setting document. There's a lot more to go into here, but I want to just highlight it a little bit. And we hopefully will still have kind of an AEM survey webinar or something to hear from Todd Green, Professor Todd Green, who put this figure together and wrote up that little section of the GS of the document. And to learn and hear more from the Stanford partners as well. But so just orientation here, this is a cross section. Yeah, let me pause. You wanna jump in, George, with a question?
Yeah, well, this one was up. I was just curious if there was any surprises when you did the helicopter work.
Yeah, I think, good question. Any surprises with the helicopter work? I think one of the things that is coming out of it and that we were hoping for is this just a better picture of understanding where do we have, you know, where do we truly have a shallow aquifer and a deep aquifer that are somehow separated? by a clay zone, you know, a clay layer zone. And I think one of the things that came out of that is that here, so this is a cross section. Let me just back up. This is a cross section. The colors here indicate the probability. So there's still uncertainty in AEM data, right? It's not a perfect clear picture of what the subsurface looks like either, but high probability, these red colors, high probability that it's coarse dominated. So, you know, brighter colors are more certain. And then the deeper colors are less certain that it's coarse grained, which means you're more certain that it's fine grained. So on the east side here, you know, this area, you see a lot of coarse grain really from top to, you know, 200 below ground surface or below sea level. Whoops. So a depth of about 350 feet, 300 to 400 feet over here. And then this same kind of package of coarse grain material dives down deeper, and we have this wedge here, kind of a blues of high probability of fine grain that comes in. And then there's shallow, you know, kind of mix on the top. So I think a little bit, not surprised in some ways, it's consistent with some of our understanding of how things, you know, how the Tuscan formation changes characteristics as you move from east to west and as you move kind of from northeast to southwest, as the material of the Tuscan formation got reworked and moved around by the river systems in the valley. But I think just a clearer picture in a lot of ways of kind of how the zones are different and how it changes over space. So just moving, so I snapped out essentially this cross section starts here in the east and it goes across and then it jets upward to the north and then over to the west. And so I pulled out of the entire figure just this east-west cross section right here, and that's what's over here. And then I inserted, this is Highway 99, so there's a monitoring well right here that's pretty close to Highway 99, so everything over here is east of 99, and then this monitoring well is basically right on the midway, so that's about where the midway is. So just to give you, you know, try to orient you a little bit to where you are. And you're essentially taking a view of the subsurface down to about, you know, this is about 1,000 feet below sea level, so about 1,100, 1,200 feet deep. So pretty incredible way to get kind of a view of what things look like down there, with a lot more data than we have, you know, from just distinct places where we have wells. So just switching to the next one, which is just this western straight line across, you know, from Butte County across the Sac River to Glenn County. Here you see a pretty different system, right, than what you saw in the east, where you have, you know, higher probability of coarse grain materials on top, this pretty thick zone of high probability fine grain materials, and then this deeper high probability of coarse grain materials. So aquifer materials at depth, and this is really what people have talked about as being the lower Tuscan pressurized zone, right, is down here at depth 600 feet below ground surface, so you're really looking at 750 feet to over 1,000 feet, right, which is separated by this fine grain zone. But the question still remains, what's the connectivity between these zones? And there was some work, you know, pump tests from the MNT from the Lower Tuscan Aquifer study, and monitoring wells that give us some clues as to what the vertical connectivity is between these two zones, or three zones really. So just want to highlight that. Happy to take any other questions about this, and like I said, I may not be able to answer details, and it really warrants, I think, its own presentation by Todd and by Rosemary from Stanford, but wanted to give the chance for anyone to ask questions about it too. So I'll just pause there.
Any questions, Shack members? And let me just ask a number ending with 4750. hit star 6 to get off mute. Who's calling in on 4750? Well, we have that person identify themselves, Bruce, and then Gary, your hands are up.
Am I next?
Bruce?
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, that's a great presentation. And what's really nice about that is how well the electric logs correlate with the layers from AEM, which is, I think, what everybody was hoping for. Mm-hmm. But just absolutely great way to show it.
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's pretty cool. There's more to learn from that data set. There is, you know, it's rich, but I think that is, I was really, really thrilled that Todd was able to pull it together to get it in the basin setting document. And I think it adds a lot to being able to understand our system a little bit better.
Gary?
Christina, on the previous slide, if you could go back one.
Oops, sorry. Yep.
Whoops. That one. The bottom black line that goes on the left from around 1,100 feet up to the surface,
yeah,
in the foothills, does that somewhat resemble the groundwater, fresh groundwater, and then other groundwater below it, not favorable groundwater level?
Yeah, I don't think so. Todd created these surfaces, so each of these black lines is kind of a surface based on the entire data set, so not just this one cross section. But I don't think it necessarily corresponds to fresh water above and salt water below, but we could talk to him about that to see if he has a sense of what that relationship might be related to that line.
Christine, this is Joe. I work with Todd on some of this, and it's, yeah, not necessarily, he's calling it the Chico N ione. There are portions of the ione that can be saline, but that's not consistent across the basins. There are places where the ione actually has fresh water. So you wouldn't really know unless you do the chemistry with the EC, whether we're looking at areas with the saline water or not.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. And I think we've taken samples out of this well here from the deep zone, and it wasn't saline, I don't think. So that goes along with that. Yeah, Joe, anything else you want to say about this that you think is a good time to?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. Just the one feature where you see that big part where he puts in the valley fill.
Yeah.
You know, these are other things that are really important to find, and basically what it is are the old paleo channels, that like where the Feather River was, where it's working. And these are areas we want to know because they're where we can get, you know, crossing of zones and where the majority, a lot of the water movement is going to be. So seeing if there's really important to understand the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Anything else on this before I keep going? Alrighty. Okay, so then switching gears over to the more water budget portions of the document, I pulled this table and graph out, mostly because in earlier presentations, a lot of what was presented and shown were kind of average annual results, and this gives more, you know, the yearly change. So this is the historical time period, 2000 to 2018. The colors show the water year type. So warm colors are dry years and cool colors are wet years. And then the change, the cumulative change in groundwater storage. So you see almost, you know, over 400,000 acre feet less storage over this time period, which corresponds over about the 20 years corresponding to that 20,000 acre feet per year reduction in storage that we had talked about before. And then you can see too just how pumping changes. And I think it's important to note, right, that pumping is going up and down pretty drastically, right? There's pretty big swings in pumping from wet years to dry years and over this time period, but not, you know, an obvious upward increase over the last 20 years that would really be just demand driven. So there's obviously been shifts in crop types and some shifts in demands over the last 20 years as well, but what's dominating the trend in estimates of pumping are kind of wet year, dry year cycles. And so you see that too. The other thing to note, we talk about Vina being a groundwater dependent basin, which is obviously correct and true, but there is some surface water that's used in the sub basin, mostly from Butte Creek. And so it obviously is less available in critically dry years and more available in wet years. And groundwater pumping also increases, right? Water demand, just to make up for precipitation that doesn't occur. There's more irrigation that's needed. And so you see pretty big swings in groundwater storage between wet years, you know, an additional over 100,000 acre feet of water that gets added to the system to storage in wet years, and then almost the opposite, 85 or almost 85,000 acre feet reductions in dry and critical years. So just helpful to see, I think, the dynamics of the system and how it swings. So this is the water budget table, groundwater system summary table, and I wanted to just point out a couple things here. First of all, correction to the totals here were made in this table, and we'll make that fix for the final document. But subsurface inflows, right? So these are flows coming into the groundwater system from underground, around, all the way around the basin, overall up just a little bit. Now I'm just looking at kind of over our scenario. So trying to get an idea, as you know, let me back up. Just reminding you, we have the historical time period. So now these are average annuals over historical, which was 2000 to 2018 average for that time period. And then the rest of the table kind of switches gears more into this modeling scenario space, where the current is, all of these are averaged over the 50-year hydrology. So it's a longer hydrology period. Current used, I believe, 2015, 2016 land use, so which was the most available land use that we had available to us. And then these scenarios introduce future development, which is essentially current general plan for urban growth and land use with no climate change, and then 2030 climate change, 2070 climate change. So I'm just looking at kind of over these scenarios, getting an idea of how does this system respond to changing climate as, you know, as simulated by the scenarios. We see a slight increase in subsurface inflows with the more change to climate, which is affecting precipitation and stream inflows to the system. And then a little bit more deep percolation, although if you drill down, that's actually coming from additional applied groundwater. So, you know, that's kind of tied to your groundwater pumping. What's interesting to point out, I think, is that seepage from streams is very stable, right, over these scenarios, not a lot of change in terms of recharge from streams. Outflows to surrounding basins goes down a little bit, right, by about 5,000 acre feet. Groundwater pumping goes up, and drilling down, again, that's driven by agricultural groundwater pumping over these scenarios from 180, almost 185 to almost 207. And then the other thing that changes more significantly is decreased western boundary net outflows, which is largely driven by interactions with the Sacramento River as well. As you'll recall, the western boundary net outflows is a combination of both flows that are going out through the groundwater system or into the Sacramento River as an outflow. So I just wanted to pull, kind of zoom into this stream seepage, because this is also something that wasn't talked about quite as much in the webinar and was expanded upon a bit in the document. So thinking about interconnected surface water, just wanted really briefly, essentially, whether the stream is getting water from the groundwater system or whether the stream is recharging and losing water to the groundwater system is really all about the relationship between the level of the stream and the level of the groundwater in relation to it, right? So whether it's gaining or losing depends on where, what the play is between those two water levels. So this is a figure that, based on Butte Basin groundwater model results, is indicating. So first of all, these are all the streams that are simulated by the model, right? Quite a few of them. One of the reasons we went with the Butte Basin groundwater model is because it simulates each of these individual streams, whereas the more regional models just have the Sacramento River, Big Chico Creek, and Butte Creek. And so the map over here shows in orange losing reaches that are losing more than 80% of the time, and then the number shows you how much of the time they are gaining. So essentially, most indicated by the Butte Basin model, most of the time or all of the time, these streams, as they come into the valley on the east side, are not connected to the groundwater system, except when you get further to the west, where groundwater levels are shallower, and then there's portions of the Sac River that are very connected and gain a lot of the time. So this warrants some additional the water budget, right? If this is the condition, if the streams are disconnected from the groundwater system, then they're not sensitive to changing conditions, whether additional pumping or changing climate scenarios. And you see that in the water budget. So I just wanted to point that out. And then lastly, before I go to just summary of comments, this figure again shows kind of over time the cumulative change in storage for these different scenarios. And so again, you see overall between the different scenarios, a very similar trend, right? Same types of patterns of increased groundwater storage and decreased groundwater storage over the hydrologic variability, but it's a bit exacerbated under the future conditions, 2070 climate change. So this decline from here to here during this drought is a little bit steeper or deeper than it was under the current conditions. So I think I looked at it and it's about roughly 30,000 or 40,000 acre feet greater decline in cumulative groundwater storage under the climate change future condition scenario compared to current. So just to give an idea of kind of how these scenarios impact the water budget, and that is just helping us to understand what pieces of the groundwater system and surface water systems are sensitive to different types of changes. Okay, so with that, I'm going to switch gears to, this is just text out of the staff memo that was included in your packet for reference. And so really some main themes of the comments that were submitted was highlighting the importance of the multiple aquifer zones. So we talked about that a little bit, and it has implications and the pressurized nature of the deeper zones. And a number of comments kind of highlight these different implications of that aspect. And it relates to understanding flow paths, vertical gradients, groundwater conditions and the connectivity between zones, interbasin flow in the pressurized deep aquifer zone, connection of shallow groundwater to deeper zones, and vulnerability of groundwater-dependent ecosystems, being able to accurately or effectively assess recharge projects, right? Understanding how the shallow end zones are connected, shallow and deep zones are connected, and then delayed and long-lasting potential effects of deep pumping on the stream groundwater interactions. So that's kind of a summary of a number of different comments along those lines, and why really understanding the zones and the nature of the connectivity and the pressurized nature of different parts of the aquifer, what different implications that has. Secondly, that was pointed out as a data gap, that monitoring, you know, the different defined aquifer zones is a data gap that should be filled with monitoring groundwater levels in each zones, and that could also be used to better define cross sections and contours and vertical gradients. And then monitoring the shallowest portion of the groundwater system was identified as a need, to identify baseline and dynamic water levels that support groundwater dependent ecosystems, and it really, and a shallow monitoring network really needs to be developed and implemented to understand what's going on in that shallowest portion of the aquifer system. And then there was a comment related to rooting depth of Valley Oaks and how the Nature Conservancy has handled that, and that the urban forest should, in Chico, should also be identified as a GDE. So more to come on GDEs. And then there were a number of clarification questions and comments. So largely my takeaway, and you all can give feedback on this and share, you know, what you saw in the comments or what you want to highlight or ask questions about the documents themselves as well. But largely a lot of the comments related to the hydrogeologic conceptual model are understanding and characterization of the aquifer system and how we're able to monitor it or how we're not able to monitor it because of data gaps. And so, you know, there's a number of things that either need to, could be revised to better clarify that or incorporated into kind of future analysis. Other issues that have been raised in the past is understanding interbasin flow connection. And that is still, I consider that an issue that's still kind of in the works of being addressed. There is an interbasin coordination group and between the subbasins in the northern Sacramento Valley, around mostly centered around the Sacramento River. And the managers met with the technical teams from all of those subbasins just a few weeks ago and are beginning to put together a template to be able to, you know, insert and compare water budget numbers and really understand how interbasin flows are being characterized by these different modeling tools and the different water budgets, and also kind of conceptually what the connection along those boundaries looks like. So stay tuned, more to come on that in the next few months. And then another issue that's been raised in the past is climate change and the climate change scenarios that were used in the basin setting chapter, and that they don't really include potential for multi-decade drought or more extreme climate scenarios. So just to give you an idea of where we're headed, and then I'll open it up for you all today. Hope we have, you know, some time, good time for a discussion and questions on these documents, some direction, and then that will go to the GSA board in October, and I'll provide some overview for them on these documents, on the comments that were received, on your discussion and recommendations, and then the document can be revised based on the direction from the GSA board. Okay, so enough from me. Yeah, how would you like to?
Thank you, Christina. So as Christina said, this is really an opportunity, and I see Greg, your hand is up. I'll go to you in a second for you to ask any questions about anything that Christina has presented, anything that she has included in this presentation and her memo, and any questions or thoughts you have about the summary of comments, because we did include those comments with your packet. So let's open it up and see what's on your mind and what you'd like to discuss more, and we'll go from there. Greg?
Yes, when you talk about climate change, you know, I've read a few things where, of course, we went from global warming to climate change. And some say that in climate change, we're going to have some cooling effects in the winter and more snow. So, I mean, the only thing I hear talking about on climate change is that we're going to have a mega drought and a shortage of water. Why can't another scenario be put in there on climate change where we'll have an increased snowpack?
Yep. It could be. And I think that that's really where we would want direction and discussion kind of specifically on this topic from the SHAC, to say, what do you want to explore? You know, what kind of possible change conditions do you want to explore to better understand how this system might respond to either wetter conditions or drier conditions, or what conditions would be helpful for your planning process?
Thanks, Greg. Jim?
Good morning. On climate change, the mega drought scenario is something that actually precedes the human-induced climate change having to do with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Apparently, the paleoclimatologists have identified numerous sequences of long-term drought that have occurred over the past millennia. And climate change just exacerbates that by increased heat during the warm months. So I just wanted to make that clear that these that the examination, the scenario of looking at different climate than what we have become accustomed to isn't necessarily associated with the carbon pollution that everyone is talking about, but has to do with paleoclimatological studies that go back many thousands of years that show periods of 100 to 200 year droughts, even longer, that have occurred in the West. On slide 11, you showed the stream leakage in the various creeks that run through our area. And it doesn't appear to me that it gives any indication of when these streams may be gaining. During the winter, when these streams are flowing, and the shallow aquifer is perhaps interacting with it. I don't know for sure, but you know, obviously these streams aren't leaking dry all year long. During the winter and spring, when we're lucky enough to get rain, they do flow. And the habitat values of these streams have to do with the timing of the dewatering of the streams. And this shows stream leakage, but it doesn't necessarily show stream dewaterings. And this is something that that Jeffrey Davids has been investigating, and that we're looking for funding to be able to expand his monitoring of these streams, especially the ones that provide really critical rearing habitat for out-migrating salmon and steelhead. So that's something we really need to identify. But besides just recognizing that they're losing streams, we need to know when they're going dry and where they're going dry. And trying to manage with some of those things in mind. On slide 9.
Wait a second, can we pause there before you move on?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so just maybe some clarification on this figure, because there is a lot going on. So the colors is what percent. It's colored based on if it's in that category over 80% of the time. And then the number is the percent that it has gaining conditions. So according to the Butte Basin groundwater model, right, this is not ultimate truth by any means, but what it's suggesting is that like the Butte Creek section here is never gaining. So, but in the Butte Basin model and in real life, right, you have inflows coming out of the foothills that are in the model are specified based on either gauge data or estimates. And so rainfall and runoff and really accretions perhaps in the foothill areas feed these streams. As you point out, you know, they don't run dry all the time, but they're getting water essentially from runoff, surface water runoff. So that's what the figure is suggesting.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
Yeah.
And what about the other one? What's the color coding on that? I'm trying to figure out what that is.
This one, yeah, good question. So this is just showing the different stream segments. So in the model, a stream segment can have different parameters related to, you know, geometry, so the shape of it, and also what its conductivity is, the stream bed conductivity, so what its connection is to the groundwater system in terms of the characteristics of that material of the stream. So it's just giving you an idea that's each of those segments could potentially have different characteristics in the model.
And there's a key for that somewhere?
Yeah, there's more documentation on that. And actually we have a documentation report on the Butte Basin groundwater model itself, and we'll get that posted pretty soon as well.
Excellent, thank you. And I had a question on slide 11 that shows inputs and outputs. And in in total and western boundary net outflows. It shows historical 56,000 approximately, current 77,000. And can you describe why the current is 20,000 more than it has been in historic, the western boundary net outflows?
Probably not off the top of my head. That is a good question. Just going back to, so a couple things that we would need to look at to probably answer that question is what, you know, what's going on with the Sac River, because that term combines that. So I'm not sure kind of what role the Sac River has in that increase versus what role subsurface flow has in that. But that's something that we could look into more. Yeah, that is a significant jump.
Right. And Christina, could I ask just a follow-up? Do you think that the underbasin coordination discussions that we're having will help to answer that question potentially?
Potentially, and just understanding maybe relative drivers between, you know, the stream interaction and subsurface flow, but these, well, actually, Jim, it's probably driven by, in part by the different time period. So the current and the following scenarios are an average of the 50-year time period, which essentially isn't that mega drought time, whereas the historical is 2000 to 2018. So I'm guessing that's partly or maybe mostly the driver there between.
Oh, so you're thinking with drought conditions, there's more outflow from
There's less outflow. Because with drought conditions, groundwater levels are lower. And so you would have less outflow to the Sac River, right? It would gain less.
Mm-hmm.
And you would potentially have less subsurface outflow also.
I don't see how that correlates with these figures when the historic is less than the current, when the historic has more precipitation and now we have less precipitation and more outflow. At least that's how I'm reading this graph, this chart.
Wait, where do you see precipitation?
While you're mentioning that during the current is including the past years where we've had less than we have during the historic period.
Right. So if you're, well, I would have to give this some more thought.
Okay.
I don't want to go into the weeds too much and lead us astray in incorrect thinking. So those are just a couple ideas, but we can take a closer look. It would be good to tease that out. But I know that some of the disconnect between the historical and then the other scenarios has to do with that, the difference in the time period that's averaged. So that may be part of it here as well.
Okay. I don't know exactly where we are in our discussion right now. I've got other comments to make, but I don't want to totally dominate the discussion. So I'll hold off until my cue comes up to talk about some of the things in comments that were not necessarily covered in the summary.
Okay, Jim, we'll get back to you.
Thank you.
George?
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So stay on slide 9. One thing you said, Christina, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought you had it flipped. I thought current was 2000 to 2018. Historical was the longer period of record. I thought you said it the other way.
Okay, so it's confusing because current uses land use from 2015 and 2016 for like the land use footprint. But it uses, I believe you're right, 2016 to 2018 for urban demands. So it's trying to get kind of a snapshot of like our most recent possible with available data of current demands. So in that way it's current, but these numbers are average annual numbers over the 50 year time period. Does that help?
Another was more just kind of a observation point. I know in your notes at the end, you talked about climate change being a big question. You know, I think in the scenarios we looked at, it kind of, you know, it was a big mix of bag. But for me, one of the big ones when you're looking all the way out to 2070 is our ag demands. And that to me is probably a bigger question mark as you get changing products and things people grow and more efficiencies in the ag world for their uses. That's probably to me a bigger question mark than climate change.
Yeah. And we don't attempt to guess at that, right? In these scenarios. But you can get an idea for how changing demands affect the system by looking at these scenarios, right? Yeah.
That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, George.
Yeah, thanks, George.
Sheree?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a few comments about the climate change situation and write some more Chico specific, but also scaling up regionally about climate change and climate modeling. I currently serve as the chair of the City of Chico's Climate Action Plan. And so we've been diving deep into the climate change scenarios moving into the future. In 2018, the City of Chico adopted a climate change vulnerability assessment. And that assessment used a tool called CalAdapt. And the CalAdapt tool was used to predict out future climate scenarios going out potentially as far as 100 years. And I'm happy to share those resources separately with you or anybody else who's interested. With that, in that assessment, it did predict that Chico and the surrounding region would be impacted by increased frequency, intensity, and duration of extreme heat days and waves, by increased flooding. So we have kind of this oscillation of precipitation, increased flooding, decreased snowpack and water supplies, and increased wildfire risk, which obviously has impacted us most intimately of recent. So just wanted to add that for context and clarification and how at least the City of Chico is predicting out some climate change vulnerabilities and some of the tools that they are using to predict that.
Yeah, great. That's really helpful. Thanks, Sheree. And I'd have to go back and look or ask Byron. It's possible that some of the data sources came from CalAdapt also. I'm not sure. But we could double check on that. I think it's really helpful to know, yeah, what other local agencies in our community, how, you know, what tools and approaches they're using.
Right, yeah. Thank you. And thank you for this, Christina. This is great information.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Anne?
I have a couple of questions regarding the basin setting data. On your current summary that uses the 50-year data, is it possible to substitute those last 2 years with information from 2019 and 2020 instead of repeating, I think it's 2004 and 2005? I just think that would improve the accuracy of the data to actually put the real numbers in there.
Yeah. So probably not for this GSP because 2020 data won't really be all available until the end of 2020. So there's always kind of at least a 1 year and usually a 2 year lag essentially between when you can take the data and then incorporate it into the modeling tool. But
as we go,
go ahead.
Sorry.
So the most recent one that we have is 2018, and we could pull 2018 into this table as kind of the most recent.
Okay. As we go forward, will that 50-year time span move from 1971 to say 1972, 3, 4, and so on?
Yeah, good question. I mean, so right, as the next time we update this, we would certainly replace 2004 and 2005 with 2019 and 2020, so that it's the real 50 years, and then probably, right, but that, I don't know, I guess that could be decided, but probably the 50 years would move forward in time. Does that make sense?
Okay.
As you're saying.
Yeah, I think Sigma is the reason that we chose 50 years, the regulations, is that right?
Right.
Is there any possibility that we could also run this on a 30-year timeline, say 1990 or 91 forward, which would shorten that period so that our most recent information has a bigger effect on our groundwater storage deficit?
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a little more up to date than using the 50-year timeline.
The full 50, yeah. Yeah, essentially, I mean, kind of the beauty of modeling, now that it's been run and it's calibrated, all of these numbers are there. So if we wanted to take an average of just those 30 years instead of the 50, that could be done, yeah.
I think it would be nice if we could do something like that to help correlate the current situation with this long time span of data that may not be too applicable these days. Then I wanted to ask if the future scenarios, did they include the likelihood that there will be early runoff and a lower snowpack?
Right, yeah, they do, in that essentially the inputs for stream flow are adjusted based on climate model adjustments for shifting and for less snowpack, yeah. So yes.
Okay. Oh, I just wanted to mention that you had that link to the PPIC data, and I looked at that and I just thought it was interesting that if you look at their data, which extends from 1950, so it's quite a long time period, there has been a very consistent percentage of around 40% of water years that are above normal. So, and it doesn't matter if you look back at the first 40 years or the last 40 years, it's all pretty stable. So that means that 3 out of 5 years are on the dry side. And if you look back at your, I think it was slide 5, it shows the, yes, down at the bottom there, the one you pulled up first,
that one,
yes, at the bottom, it just shows the gains we expect in a wet year versus the losses we expect in a below normal, dry or critical year. And if you kind of look, that two of those are wet and three of them are dry, then, you know, it really does look like we have quite a deficit there. Or that we can expect a deficit unless things change. And also that PPIC data really suggested that the biggest change was the increase in average temperature that we have experienced. So I just wanted to point that out. And then my last comment was that I'm kind of concerned that I'm not hearing anything about domestic wells. I don't know if the AEM data helps to clarify that. I have no idea what the county has in terms of information on domestic wells. Last time we talked about public outreach quite a bit. I have no idea where these domestic wells are or who has them. And so I am at a bit of a loss as to how I'm going to do public outreach. And I would really like us to make a commitment to improving domestic well monitoring data. I think there are people out there who are not tech savvy, and often the wells will be old because they are poor, and we just don't have any information. I also wonder how we're going to set minimum thresholds if we don't know how many wells may go dry.
Yeah, so some of that is still to come. We haven't, you're right, we haven't characterized really or laid out the landscape of wells, domestic or agricultural. So yeah, stay tuned for that. That is a super important piece for evaluating the thresholds and all of that. And then just one other thing.
That's it.
That was it for you, Anne?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you for those comments. I just wanted to return to one of your thoughts on the 50-year time frame, and just point out that on the scenarios, really the advantage of using the 50 years is, or one of the reasons you might do that is it's capturing the historical hydrology of those 50 years, but it's mapping on top of that. For the current demands, or you know, a climate adjusted hydrology, but with kind of the variability of the 50-year time period. So if you want to look at just the variability that we saw since 1990, then you would want to average, you know, the last 30 years and just say, I really am interested in the hydrologic variability that we've seen since 1990. But that's kind of separate from like the land use or the pumping demands or things like that.
I think my main concern is that, you know, we have this sustainable yield estimate that's round about 1,000 acre feet per year. And I just don't think that's terribly accurate. And I would hate to see us plan everything on that basis and 5 years now from now having to walk back on what we did because it was inadequate. I think we would be better to prepare ourselves for a worse scenario rather than what I think is a too optimistic one.
Yeah, and that's really this is just information and then you decide what you want to plan for. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Anne. And I know that, I know, Jim, that you said you had other comments. I'd would like to first go to the public to see if members of the public have any questions or comments, and then take a break, and we'll come back and continue the discussion, which will be focused on recommendations, but we also can take some additional comments if necessary. Let me just ask members of the public if you have any questions or would like to weigh in this discussion, questions or comments or anything else, anything you'd like to contribute to the discussion. Okay, hearing none. We are at 10:47.
Samantha just raised her hand, Tanya.
Samantha, go ahead.
I guess I just wanted to say that there are a lot of assumptions in this model about things that pertain to ag, like land use, root thickness, and I would like to see more exploration there before trying to predict what is going to happen in the future. A good example is the population of the city of Chico has quadrupled in the last 50 years, and on the table 1-8, the assumption is being made that water use for urban industrial use is going to have no change in the future. And I just can't see how the population is going to stabilize in the city of Chico just based on history. So I would just like to see these assumptions about land use and both for the domestic well users as the ag users and the urban users before, you know, accepting the results of the model.
Yeah, that's a really good comment. Maybe George, put you on the spot. Could you describe, I know that those were based on urban water management plan projections. Do you want to comment on?
Yes, I sure can. And urban water management plans utilize local government decisions in planning for the future. So it's too much, I think, to ask for our team to start digging into growth projections. That's why we rely on the cities and the counties and their general plans. They're the ones that are doing the projections, and those are the projections that are used in urban water management plans. So it seems similar that, or reasonable that we would use those. Whether they're right or wrong, I don't know, but to double, I mean, I don't think we have the funding to double up efforts on doing additional population projections that other entities are already doing. Hopefully that helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to describe where those came from. So yeah, that was urban water management plan numbers. But Samantha, to your other point about, you know, how are the ag, you know, what are all the assumptions that are going into the estimates of ag demand? That is documented in the model documentation, and we do need to get that posted. But when we updated the model to support the water inventory analysis project report that was completed in 2016, quite a bit of that, well, really that work focused on the land surface water budgets, which includes the estimates of water demand for ag and land use and soil parameters. And you're right, you put numbers in there for target thresholds in terms of when the model calls for irrigation and things like that. And we ran a lot of those numbers by a couple different grower groups to just get a sense of, okay, we're estimating, you know, X number of acre feet per year for almonds, for walnuts, for rice. Does that seem about right? You know, so there was that kind of conversation that happened earlier on in model development a few years back. But we'll get the model documentation posted, because that's an important piece to understand what some of those pieces are that are really the building blocks for these numbers. So thanks for that.
Thank you, Christina. So we'll look forward to sharing that information once it is available and posted, right? Yeah. So again, we're just going to take a quick 5-minute break. If everyone can just stay connected to Zoom, just turn off your camera and go on mute. Let's take 5 minutes. So we'll come back around 10:56 or 10:57, just before 11 o'clock. So see you in 5 minutes. Thank you. Okay, Shack members, as you're coming back, if you could either turn your camera on so that we know that you're there, or just give me a quick response in the chat so that I know you're there if you can't turn on your camera. Okay, thank you. Thank you all. again, if you can turn on your camera so I can see that you're there, if you have the bandwidth to do so, that'd be great. Jim, I see that your hand is up. Go ahead.
In the basin setting, my comments included the comment that the pressurized nature of the deep aquifer wasn't covered. And this is related to another comment that I submitted, that I think it's really important to differentiate recharge efficacy between different zones when discussing recharge projects that have thus far dominated the management action discussions. Presumptions of the efficacy of applied water for intentional recharge might be logical for the unconfined shallow aquifer zones, but seem illogical to me when attempting to maintain or restore deep aquifer confined pressurized zones that lie beneath the geologic aquitard layers that would prevent water from leaking downward into these pressurized zones. And this is related that external demand is likely to impede meeting our groundwater sustainability plan objectives if we don't have really close and open communication between ourselves and adjacent, especially on the western boundary. The deepest portion of the Tuscan A extends well into Glenn County, where the deepest wells are located in the most downgraded portion of the aquifer. And assuming that the 3,000 to 5,000 gallon per minute wells that GSID has installed to supplement their river supplies during watering up when they're coordinating with fisheries to forego taking water out of the river, assuming that these river supply, that these deep Tuscan supplies will be used, this information is really critical for our efforts to compose interbasin cooperation and any ideas of investing time into recharging an aquifer when it may just leak into users on the other side of the river. So I think this is an important thing to keep in mind in the basin setting and also in the interbasin coordination group and technical group management that Christina was talking about. And one final comment, and this has to do with subsidence. And I know over in Glenn County, there were areas of subsidence when GSID did operate their high volume wells, but their subsidence monitoring didn't capture it because their subsidence monitoring network was far too spaced apart. And the subsidence that was occurring that was affecting one landowner that I'm familiar with over there wasn't caught by the widespread subsidence monitoring. And when I looked at our subsidence monitoring network, it looks like we've got nodes that are about 3 up to 10 miles apart. And so the subsidence that might occur in the 1 to 3 mile zone might be invisible to this monitoring grid. And my question is, will satellite monitoring be frequent and nimble enough to observe initial stage of subsidence? Or are we planning on expanding our subsidence network? Or is our geology just not prone to subsidence? Those are three questions that I don't know the answer to. And maybe some of our consultants would know that. Thanks for taking my comment, Tanya.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
Christine.
I don't know about increased. So there is the GPS, you know, survey monuments that you're talking about that are not super high density, but they're throughout the Sac Valley. I think that DWR, I think one of the things that they're making available, and maybe Joe Turner, maybe you can speak to this too, is more statewide and satellite subsidence. And that's certainly, you know, as it's available, that's something that we will utilize in these subbasins. As far as the geology, Joe, could you speak to that?
Yeah, to your first question, yes, DWR is planning on expanding what they have for subsidence, and that will come out in the future. Regarding the geology, most of the Tuscan formation is not really conducive to subsidence. It has a lot of sandstones, and it doesn't have those, for lack of a, you know, where they have problems down in the south where they've had subsidence, it's because they've been shrinking the clay units, which don't come back. And that's not something we see in the Tuscan formation. We have a lot of sandstones, the Lahar units that are cemented. Might be something, Glynn County's probably seen it because they get more into Tehama, which are more sands that might subside, but they don't really have the clays. And sounds like it's more of a local phenomenon. It just depends on where the pumping came from. And as far as long-term, we'll definitely set in criteria looking at it. We'll do the best job of what we have, but if things happen, we'll have to, you know, alter as we go into the future. If we start seeing subsidence, we'll have to start reevaluating the criteria and what we need to do. So that's part of the process. We make the best estimate we can at the start, and this is just based on available knowledge. The process has set that there's going to be changes because we're going to get new data, and every 5 years, at a minimum every 5 years, we got to look at it and readjust if we see things going on. So as we go through the 20-year implementation period, we'll be looking at those things, and we need to make adjustments. Adjustments will be made on whatever criteria we set up at the start.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. This really is the starting point of groundwater management, right, in the Vina Subbasin. And as we learn more and fill these data gaps over time, we can adjust how we manage things.
Yeah, and I'm not sure whether we set it up as a data gap. I Butte County, we haven't seen a lot of any subsidence, just as I said, because of the geologic formations, but when you're setting up the data gaps, you also have to set up an implementation plan. So we'll set everything in base what we know now, and then we're going to identify what the data gaps are. But we also have to identify when we're going to put in programs to fulfill those data gaps, what we're going to do. And we have to put a schedule and implementation plan together also on collecting that data.
Thanks, Joe. Christina, I'm going to hand it off to you to move into the next segment of our discussion.
Okay, I'm going to share screen again here. And I teed up just because, hold on a second. Just because these topics have come up, and I think it would be helpful for staff in some ways to get more clear direction, like on the climate change topic of let me back up. So I highlight kind of these two topics, shallow monitoring network, because it's come up and it's important, and that's an option for you to discuss and see if you want to have a recommendation out on that topic. And then I raised the climate change also. And there's a couple different kind of ways that you could go with that. We can take advantage of existing information that we have from the model and kind of milk it more for understanding based on the historical period or based on different things that you might be interested in. We could also step back and say, okay, the basin setting is what it is. It provides kind of a backdrop of information. Now we're moving into more of a management realm as we begin to develop sustainable management criteria and then also develop projects and management actions. And maybe that's where you think it's really important to have some guidance on what types of climate scenarios do you want to see used to evaluate, say, any particular project or any particular policy. And so you could provide some input on that and also clarify what that scenario should look like and wouldn't have to be one, you know. So some of those things have been talked about already. Or you could, you know, suggest that additional model runs really should be done to better understand the backdrop and frame management. And that would be kind of a GSP update task. We don't have the time or the funding really to do that right now to support the rest of the GSP development. And it's not going to be a final product, right? This is really a starting point. So, and can be updated in the future. So I don't know which, or you can tackle a different topic. If something else, you know, came up for you or for you as a group that you want to weigh in on or provide direction on, that's of course welcome as well.
Thank you, Christina. So the higher level here is now that we have the basin setting chapters and we're having these discussions, we receive the comments and we're having SHAC members are having their own conversation about this. The suggested action here is there any either input, additional input to the VINA GSA Management Committee and are there potential recommendations that the SHAC would like to make to the VINA GSA Board of Directors related to these draft GSP chapters? And what Christina has just described is that she in the staff report, she presented potential recommendations basically to seed the conversation, right? Based on the comments that have been received, not to be prescriptive. So if there's anything else that you really want to bring forward as a potential recommendation that's isn't on this list related to shallow monitoring as a potential data gap or how to address climate change scenarios and how you would like to, what scenarios you would like to see to guide planning, then please bring those up. And one thing that I just want to, it's already been said several times, but I just want to emphasize that the five-year updates aren't optional. They're a requirement under SGMA. And so if there's any concern, for example, that those wouldn't occur and, you know, you have to get it just right in this first plan, it's important to know that what's required in SGMA are annual reports and annual updates, as well as a requirement for five-year updates to the actual GSP, where you can integrate additional information so that if there aren't resources now, nor the time to meet the compliance deadline of January 2022, that those things can be carried forward into those five-year updates. I know you already said it, I just felt like it's a part of a mandatory process in the regulations that was worth putting a fine point on. Mm-hmm. So now, any comments on anything I've said there, Christina?
Yeah, one more thing, just kind of along those lines too. I think the basin setting provides the backdrop for understanding the system to then be able to make, set these thresholds and make management decisions. So it's not just about revising the current documentation. It can also be like what types of things are you wanting to see or the years, even like Anne pointed out, you know, these last 30 years, maybe we want to hone in on that. That type of direction can help inform the supporting analysis for the sustainable management criteria conversation that is coming. So it's not just about, you know, changing what's currently in the basin setting document. I think even more is how do we, you know, what do you want to see and what do you find important to help support kind of the next phase of GSP development, and then it can all get integrated and taken into account that way as well.
Thank you. That was really helpful, Christina. George?
Yeah, I've got a little bit of input into the recommendations. One is that on the climate change and evaluating them, there's a lot of options out there. So right now, I think my recommendation is we ensure that we are using data that aligns with what City Chico is putting out or is utilizing that data set, making sure it's incorporated in our analysis, not as much leaning towards looking at different other scenarios. I think that's something that at the five-year update will, you know, that information and will grow a lot in the next 5 years to where we could maybe take another shot at that point. And then my other comment on the recommendation is I completely support developing a shallow monitoring network. Like Ann referred to some concerns with local, you know, single homeowner wells, they're not going to be as deep as them. My point would be we, you know, take a look and focus that monitoring network on kind of the clusters of residential homes that are dependent on their own wells. So that's my 2 points.
Thank you, George. Let's get others in the mix and then we'll revisit, see where we land. Jim and then Cherie.
Yes, I would like to see a survey and census of existing large diameter wells that are tapping into the Lower Tuscan aquifer that would include an estimate of the volume that they would be pumping, the time that they would be pumping, and in order to have a complete census, and in light of the commitment to interbasin coordination, I would like to see it go beyond, have the census include wells to the west of the Sacramento River outside of our boundary. I think it's really important to know what infrastructure is out there now that is tapping the foundation of our aquifer system, because it's very meaningful for any of the management actions we might choose to take.
Thank you, Jim. Hey, Cherie?
Yeah, I wanted to kind of second what George already said with regard to the climate change recommendation. You know, I don't know that it's worth going back, you know, looking at historic models and trying to overlay some of these future projections as much as it is important to make sure that the projects and management actions that we are recommending are in alignment with both what the City of Chico and Butte County are doing with regard to climate action planning. Both of them have climate action plans. I don't know about other cities or towns that might have climate action plans within the basin, but making sure that projects and management recommendations, but also future modeling projections are in alignment with how both of those plans are mapping out what our climate future looks like.
Thank you, Cherie, for building off of George's comments about the importance of consistency with other planning efforts that are being undertaken and that intersect with the GSP.
Sorry, Tanya, one more thing on that. Please. Just for timeline-wise, the City of Chico is right now updating their climate action plan. So the consultant is working on that and there are draft recommendations made and water has come up as part of the climate action planning conversation within the City of Chico. Public outreach is happening now for the next month or so, and I think the timeline is to have that plan finished by March of next year, just so you have a timeline perspective for that.
March of 2021.
That's correct.
Thanks. Gary?
I wanted to, excuse me, agree with George and on the shallow water monitoring. I think it's extremely important because of houses built in Chico in the 70s to the mid 80s, most of those wells that were drilled for those houses are relatively shallow, 125 feet to 200 feet. And we saw a few years ago in that drought where a lot of us lost our domestic wells, that those were the ones that, of course, are affected first. And I think this goes along with what Ann was saying, that this is going to be, and it could be, an extremely important informational thing to pass on to owners and for us all to understand better. So I truly recommend that we study the shallower aquifers and the monitoring and look for monitoring well placement in critical locations, as well as making sure that we are covering as many of the domestic wells as we can.
Thanks, Gary. That's helpful. And I just, again, want to appreciate how you're building off of one another in the discussion. That's really helpful, particularly in these online environments. Bruce, I'd like to go to you, and then Anne. Bruce, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with George and Gary. Also, while you're developing a monitoring system for the shallow wells, you may find out that many of those are also in the intermediate layers. And so that's also important. 125 feet may be below the shallow and starting to get into the intermediate. So there's a lot of monitoring that needs to be developed. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. Anne?
I would agree that I would like to prioritize shallow well monitoring, but I wondered if there was a definition of shallow.
Yeah, great question.
Oh. Is there?
Are you still talking? Okay, sorry, I couldn't tell if you were still talking. Right now, kind of the categories that have been used by DWR and by our department in describing well depths, shallow is typically less than 200 feet. Intermediate zone is 200 to 600. And then deep is greater than 600. But partly, one of the reasons I showed kind of the AEM cross-sections from that study and that data set, and what Todd, is starting to kind of create these layers, is to refine our thinking and how we characterize wells and how we characterize these zones to not be set at a certain depth like that so much, but to be a little bit more refined. In certain areas, it's going to be different, and to better define what is the shallow zone in a particular area and how that relates not only to the hydrogeology characteristics of that area, but also the well infrastructure that's in that area. So I think we have quite a bit of information that we can take advantage of right now for development of the GSP. And then there is absolutely a need for additional monitoring. So both of those can happen.
This is Joe. Just to add on to what Christina is saying, as we get into the next process, one of the things we'll be doing is setting up criteria, and we first got to describe what's undesirable. Obviously, one of those would be domestic wells going dry. So when we're setting levels and monitoring points, we'll be looking at domestic wells, and we're going to set up things like minimum thresholds, which is the lowest water level we'll want the aquifer to get to. And we'll be working with Christina on where we have monitoring. We've already asked for screen intervals of what they have in their monitoring program, looking at the depths. And when we start working with the groups, the management group, and talking with the shack, we'll be going, you know, what level in this area around there is important. And we'll be setting those criteria based on things like, you know, which wells are going to go dry, and we'll be setting those levels out. So we'll be working with where domestic wells are, what the levels are, and do we have monitoring programs to cover that? If we don't, they'll become data gaps. We may have to use deeper wells at the start, but we'll have a data gap. And, you know, if the deeper well works for monitoring that during the time and we see that, we won't have to do it. But if it's the deeper well, if it goes to a depth and we're still seeing domestic wells go dry, then you'll know we'll have to get more monitoring in those areas.
Great, yeah, thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Anne, if you have a follow-up.
Just a second question. I think when the basin setting model was reviewed, you did actually use 5 different climate data sets to determine that. Am I correct in thinking that?
I think there were only the 2, the 2030 and the 2070, but there's 4
but different out of scenarios. Out of the models out there, I seem to recall that you reviewed 5 and kind of averaged them. So this was a pretty broad climate change scenario data set that was used to establish our future 2030, 2070 scenarios. Is that right?
Right. So we didn't average them, but you're right. There were, I think, 5 or so that have different extremes. And these 2 were central tendency. You're right. Closer yes, to kind of central right. tendency. Yeah.
I remember that now. Thank
yeah,
you.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, Anne. And Jim.
Yes, this is along with the shallow well monitoring and management. I mentioned it'd be important to have a census of large diameter wells. This should collect well construction data that may show how some of these wells are screened at multiple layers, connecting the layers. And this is important because if the lowest portion is depressurized, then the upper portions can leak through these multiple screenings. And I know that a lot of the wells in the San Joaquin Valley that were chasing the water down were screened at multiple layers, and it really had an impact on the shallow aquifer as it leaked downward. And so this should be an important part of if we collect well census data. The well construction data needs to be part of that so we know what kind of connectivity there is in these large diameter wells between the different layers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim. I'd like to check in before I sort of summarize where I think we are so far in the discussion. I just want to check in with other SHAC members who we haven't heard from regarding any of the discussion so far or the recommendations that have been put out or some other ideas that you may have. So other SHAC members who we haven't heard from, would you like to weigh in on the conversation? Okay, and how about members of the public? Anything to add at this point? I'll go to you, Greg, SHAC member, Greg.
Yeah, and you know, it's a great idea to go get all the information we can on all the domestic wells and all the big ag wells, but it's cost prohibitive, I think, to go. You got to take some averages, and to set up a huge network, you know, I don't think we have enough money to do that or time. You got to take some averages on what crop uses are, et cetera. Also, I don't want to see us say things to people like we're going to protect every domestic well, let's say. I lost a domestic well a couple of years ago. Well, it was when my grandparents drilled and it only went down 68 feet. I can't expect that well to survive, you know, to be able to keep going on. So I don't think we can promise everybody we're going to protect every domestic well either. You know, in this process, we do what we can, but there are some that, you know, are old and need to be re-drilled because they were just too shallow for what's going on today. So just my point of view.
Yeah, just one thing on information is you can go to DWR's webpage on where they provide well logs and things. They also have maps that show you the average depths of average minimum and maximum depths on the information they have for domestic production and irrigation wells. So we can get a feel for the depths of the wells within a, you know, within a section of the area using that information from DWR. It doesn't give you the, you know, screen details, but it does give you total depths.
Yeah, and that's on a square mile section, right, Joe?
Correct. So, yeah.
Thanks, Joe, for pointing out that there is some existing information that can be used. And then also, as we've already mentioned here, that if the SHAC were to identify shallow monitoring as a potential data gap, then that's something that could potentially be addressed, as Christina says in her memo, through technical, so through an application to DWR for technical support services, and is something that could be addressed, in future GSP updates, right? But it is important while we're going through the basin setting process to be able to begin to identify these gaps, even if they're not going to be addressed in this initial GSP, right? So that they're tracked and carried forward. Gary, I'll go to you and then back to Ann.
I have a question of from anyone who can answer it. I can't remember how far down a domestic well has to be hard cased before it can have perforations. Could somebody tell me that?
I think it's 50 feet. I believe
50 feet, I believe, is Butte County's sanitary seal from the surface down for leakage. So that's the minimum level you can have the top of the screen. Or you got to have a 50-foot seal. Doesn't mean necessarily the top of the screen, but that's what you have to put in by the permit guidelines.
Yeah. And then my final comment here is that I agree with Jim that there are more and more large gravel pack wells going in that are connecting perched aquifers or upper aquifers, and I think it does create a conductivity between multiple aquifers with these huge gravel pack wells. And I think it's important that we know have a pretty good idea of how many there are, and is maybe in the future, is there some change rule that we need to do in particular areas because of the aquifers to maybe seal them past a perched aquifer or something of that nature. So I think gathering that information is critical.
Thank you, Gary. And do Christina or Joe or anyone do follow up if you'd like some clarification on any of the suggestions that are coming from SHAC members. Anne?
I just wanted to say I don't think that we need to protect every single domestic well. But I do think we need to have an idea of how many would be impacted by any decisions that we make and in setting minimum thresholds. And we also need to discuss in the future what we're going to do to remediate those dry wells, because I do think that would need to be part of this discussion.
Yeah.
And I did have...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop you. Finish your comment, please.
Well, I can't remember what the other thing was I was going to say.
I'm sorry. I was just going to answer that. That's exactly what we'll be doing when we're setting up the criteria and making the statement of undesirable. I mean, the statement can be like, undesirable is more than 25% of domestic wells going dry, not 0%. But that's what we work with people, what is undesirable in this area, and working out that statement of what that's going to be. And then, yes, the management actions are taken could be like, well, we got to go drill their wells deeper or something like that.
Right, right. And actually, I do remember now, the AEM data we looked at, does that help us predict which areas might have more difficulty than others in terms of domestic wells?
Not necessarily, but I think it can help us understand if we know characteristics about the wells, like the domestic wells happen, you know, or tend to be in less than 100 feet or less than 200 feet, and the ag wells happen to be somewhere else. You know, we can, if we understand where the infrastructure is and kind of the nature of the connectivity between zones, then we would make different decisions, you know, with that information than if we didn't have that information.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we do have just under 10 minutes of remaining for this agenda topic. I really appreciate the discussions that we've had. I think the Shack has been able to share a lot of good ideas. And I would like to summarize where I think we are with your input, and then to just get a sense of if you feel like we're at a point where the Shack would like to make any recommendations to the VINA GSA board, right? All of this information is being collected. We document it in the meeting notes. As you could already tell from Kelly's presentation earlier today, that information is then presented in a staff report. The staff is always here. The management committee takes this information and is applying it. So just to say that everything that's being said is being documented and will be communicated to decision makers and to staff and consultants like Joe, who's here and has been participating in the conversation. But is there anything in particular at this point, at this juncture, that you think warrants a recommendation? And so some of the things that I've heard are that around shallow monitoring network, that this has been identified as an area of interest for the Shack and potentially a priority to ensure that domestic wells and shallow monitoring are prioritized. And to a greater or lesser extent, I heard support from George. From George, Gary, Bruce, and Anne, and I believe Jim on this discussion of shallow wells, and then Greg, you wanted to just clarify. I felt like you also acknowledged the importance of shallow wells, but just wanted to put a fine point to understand that we want to be clear with the public, right? That doesn't mean that every well can be protected. But I do think that the conversations that have taken place where Joe Turner has weighed in from GeoSyntec about what the next phase of sustainable management criteria discussions may look like, and that you will make decisions and have conversations about what you consider to be potential undesirable impacts to domestic wells, and then that will define potential projects and management actions going forward. So around shallow monitoring, I'd like to ask the Shack, do you think that within the nucleus of our conversation on that topic in particular, do you think that there is some recommendation to be made to the VINA GSA board about the importance of domestic wells? Samantha?
Well, I guess in this discussion about a shallow monitoring network, I always thought that we were utilizing the visual of the health of our Valley Oaks and our stream monitoring as indicative of what's going on in the shallow portion of the aquifer. And that when our GDEs are failing and our streams begin to deplete, that would be a indication that we had something going on at the shallow level that we needed to be looking at closely. So I don't know how much a development of a monitoring network would be and if spending that money is wise, if there are other ways to do it that are not as costly.
Just maybe just one thought on that. I mean, if understanding the shallow zone is important, you point out that there may be different ways to monitor the conditions in the shallow zone, and maybe that's habitat monitoring and not just wells. So, you know, I think the next step would be to begin to talk about and evaluate what would that shallow monitoring network look like and be composed of. And you point out that maybe it's not just wells, or maybe it's not wells, maybe it's something else.
Yeah, thank you, Samantha, for noting that. And I'll go to Bruce in a moment. And I think really if there's any sort of recommendation based on what our conversations have been thus far, it really is much more aligned with what Christina just said, and that is the shack is identifying that understanding the shallow zone is important, right? And it's yet to be determined sort of the best ways to further investigate that, you know, that and characterize and protect domestic wells. But even now, what may have come out of the basin setting chapters is just a realization and a recognition that those are important, not necessarily to suggest that there should be investment in a shallow monitoring network at this time, right? Because there's still more discussion to take place. So just realize it could be also just a light touch in terms of what you want to communicate to the VINA GSA board. Bruce?
Within Chico, there are active contaminated sites. Those within the draft, between lines 118 and 167, it discusses these active sites. This well data is screened in specific layers. It's existing, it's already in place. Like I said, they're active. This can be used to determine surface water interaction when we need it. I'd suggest that we start, and it's already in the draft, by referencing these contaminated sites' wells.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for mentioning that. Okay, the other thing that I just I'd like for us to be able to wrap up this discussion. Another thing that we're hearing, and it may be timely, and we heard it specifically from George and Cherie, is the principle here that it is important to incorporate the analysis that is being done by the city and county related to climate change. And so what I think might be a higher level point for the shack to weigh in on here is ensuring consistency with other planning efforts, such as the climate action planning is important to ensure in the development of the GSP, is sort of how I'm reading that higher level point from that George made, and then that was confirmed by Cherie. I see, Bruce, is that an old hand?
That's an old hand.
Okay, I'll take it down. Samantha, your hand?
Yeah, I just wanted to piggyback on what Bruce just said about those monitoring wells. On page 50, under groundwater conditions, the ILRP monitoring is only addressing nutrients and toxins that are specific to ag. And in the wells that Bruce is discussing, those kinds of toxins are not on the radar here. And maybe that's something that we need to add to the basin setting document.
Christina, any follow-up there?
Nope, that's a good comment, and we'll take note of that and check it out. Yeah, thanks.
Well, I mean, I would like to point out as all those wells and just the understanding, they're all regulated under other state programs and followed by those programs of what the impacts are, and they have plans for cleanup. As far as SGMA and what we're doing for those is we just need to develop our plan that we can't do something that makes those things worse. So we'll keep tracking all those things, but they're regulated. They're kind of outside our ability to mandate because state agencies are already overseeing those programs and mandating what they have to do and not do. So as far as we're concerned, we need to make sure we don't do something that makes them worse. So tracking them and setting up criteria is a little outside, other than we, you know, make a statement that we're not going to go put something in and drag a plume somewhere, but they're being regulated and cleaned up by other state agencies.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're highlighted in terms of that they exist, that plume exists, and what it's there for and what the potential effect is. And then, you know, then it's on the radar when you develop SMCs, right, Joe? To do what you just said, to not make it worse.
Any follow-up there, Joe?
So I guess maybe can I just go back to Samantha and ask for clarification? What added thing are you looking for? Did that address your question or?
Well, what I'm pointing out is that we're only looking at nutrients and toxins that are specific to ag in the basin setting document. And Bruce brought up the fact that there are plumes that, even though they are being currently monitored by other agencies, you could also make the argument that other agencies are monitoring the potential for ag products that could be running off or be leaching into the groundwater. So I was saying that we should incorporate all of the information.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. Okay. So what I wanted taking away from this conversation is that there's been discussion here about the importance of ensuring that data from existing planning efforts related to climate action planning are incorporated into the GSP. And if possible, that there would be alignment between and among those efforts as a best practice, that there's been some good discussion from the SHAC about the importance of shallow monitoring, and to understand if that represents a data gap. And as we go into sustainable management criteria discussions, as well as looking more closely at the monitoring network and representative monitoring, which are still to come, those discussions in GSP planning, that this is something to track and keep an eye on and incorporate into our discussions, that there is important for there to be a survey of Jim, you raised this, and Gary also affirmed the importance of collecting well construction data and doing a survey of large wells, and potentially incorporating that interbasin coordination discussions to include wells that may be outside of the boundary of the Vina subbasin along the western Sacramento boundary. And that it's important to make sure, related to any toxic contamination or potential undesirable results associated with water quality, that all information is incorporated into the basin setting chapter in the GSP, including how it's being monitored, whether it's an ag toxins related to or associated with ag, or with other impacts. So that's sort of the summary of where I think the input that the SHAC offered. Please let me know if you have any suggested modifications to that. What I want to suggest and propose to the group is that that is going to be communicated to the Vina GSA board in a staff report, and is also being received as input to the management committee. But I'm not really drawing at this point, given that we're at the basin setting component, I'm not hearing a proposal for an actual hard recommendation to the board. And I don't know that we have to draw that distinction as long as the information is communicated. So Gary, I see that your hand is up.
Yes, a question of Christina. I noticed on your suggested recommendations for projects that you didn't include a monitoring system for mid and deep ag wells or larger production wells. Is that because you feel that the system is pretty complete, or are there some gaps there that we should be looking at or someone should be looking at?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the next step is to characterize our existing monitoring network and kind of assign them to each of these zones and see where we're at. I think that it's pretty clear that there are some gaps in the shallow zone, but I think you point out we may have some areas where we need better monitoring and in other intermediate and deeper zones too. So the whole picture needs to be assessed and will be, you know, as Joe and his team and we support the representative monitoring network selection, and that stuff is going to fall out when we start looking around for wells with particular characteristics and whether we have them available to us or not in the existing monitoring network.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd add on to that, you know, we also have to have that discussion of what's undesirable in the deeper zone. I mean, what are we going to call? I mean, I assume it's going to be things like increased pumping efficiency and things like that, and where we set the levels, and then we'll be looking at the wells that we can monitor to assess whether we're going undesirable. So we need to have that discussion too of what's undesirable for the deeper zones, and do we have a monitoring system to monitor that?
Right, so it's really good to know what's happening next, and I'm sorry to be moving us along, but we are rapidly running out of time. I think it's super helpful, and you can already see us pivoting now that the basin setting draft chapters, and they are draft because you'll be looking at the entire GSP at the sort of end of this process when these different pieces are put together. I think it's very helpful to understand that sustainable management criteria is coming next. A very important part of that is understanding what the existing monitoring network is, and to be a part for the SHAC to be a part of understanding if there are gaps in that network, whether it's at the shallow, intermediate, or deeper zones, and then to be able to move forward to the next steps and see how that affects the planning process. So Anne, any final word here before we move on? And again, I want to just confirm that all the input that you provided and how I've summarized it will be communicated to the VINA GSA board and is being taken in by the management committee. Anne, a final word here?
I am uncomfortable with recommending anything to do with climate change policy for the SHAC, because the consensus of the SHAC may not be represented by the consensus of the City Council or Chico State. So I would like to review that information before we attempt any kind of consensus on that. And I wish I didn't have two thoughts and then can't remember the second one. Oh, maybe we could have a presentation on what we know about wells in the domestic shallow GDE range, if it would be possible to just review what we actually know and perhaps help guide us as to what we would, our areas we would like to see improved. I don't know if that would be helpful. It was just a thought. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Really good input. And I suspect when we're talking about the monitoring network that is something that will be included. You make a really good point about having more information about what the climate action planning efforts look like at the county and city level. I think maybe the high level takeaway that I'm taking from this is that is consistent with any good planning. It's important for there to be an alignment and a referencing of other planning efforts that are taking place. The details of how that occurs, I understand that there's more information that is needed for the shack. So again, I think we're just summarizing the conversation and realizing that this is the beginning part of the planning process. And I'm not taking away from this conversation any sort of distinct, clear recommendations, except for sharing what has been discussed and doing that accurately. Now we have sort of run over one of the things that we wanted to by a few minutes. One of the things that we did want to do with you about 10 minutes ago was to just try to set up, like tee up the conversation that we're going to have a more in-depth conversation in October to continue conversation that we've already started related to projects and management actions. Last time, Paul Goslin did present sort of the process for PMAs. And so realizing that we're going to be moving into that conversation, we wanted to get some ideas from you about how you would like to approach that. And we did have sort of a visual aid ready to help you think that through. Christina, you were going to lead off in this discussion. We really don't have time for this today. I'm wondering, what is the most essential information that you would like from the shack, if anything, to prepare for that October conversation of related to PMAs?
Yeah, I think really the goal for today was to just get a little bit of direction from the shack on what type of conversation you would like to have around PMAs in October. First of all, October will just be the beginning initial conversation around PMAs. It's not like it's our only and final discussion. But so I think there's a couple options. One is that we just have kind of a general brainstorming discussion. So we come back in October and we say, hey, what are you guys thinking about PMAs? And you start throwing stuff on the wall and we can talk about what those different options might be, projects, policies, things that you're thinking about. The other option, another way to approach it would be for staff potentially to bring a list of PMAs that are from other GSPs that have already been submitted in other sub-basins to kind of seed the conversation. And you could potentially discuss each one and say, these are ones that we're really interested in talking about more. And okay, so this is topic number two. And these are ones that we want to put to the side in a parking lot and not talk about so much. So that might be just a different way to have the conversation and for staff to bring something to help start the conversation. A third approach is a bit different, and that is to say, instead of talking about kind of categories or specific projects and management actions, do you want to talk about what are the considerations in evaluating any kind of project or management action that we value, and how do we kind of sort out that prioritization? Are we most concerned about cost benefit? Are we most concerned about multi-benefit of projects? Are we concerned about the level of complexity, the potential of unintended consequences? What are, how do we prioritize these considerations when we are evaluating any particular project management action? Do you want to have that discussion instead? Or fourth, I think it's kind of related, but do you want to talk about things that you're most concerned about when you're going to evaluate any particular project management action? And then the management committee could work with legal to develop rules and ordinances around those potential unintended consequences. So you can see that those are, I would say, kind of three different approaches to the conversation that you could have in October, and just trying to get a gauge for how you would like to begin to tackle this discussion about PMAs.
Yeah, and what occurs to me here, Christina, and thank you, and you can see that we're just trying to put up a graphic illustration for you to aid in the conversation, is that it's not as if you have to choose one, or that we won't be doing all of these things over right. the course of the projects and management actions conversation. I think all we're getting at right now is sort of what would be most useful in the projects and management actions conversation to get the conversation going in October. And it might be that you'd like to do some general brainstorming, and you'd like to for the management committee and staff to bring in a list of PMAs from other GSPs as a reference, right? You could imagine those two things being in combination. You might think it's really important to start with a criteria conversation. That's topic three about potential considerations, but you might want to do brainstorming first and then apply criteria to it, and topic four, the sort of rule structure to it. So I think all we want right now in just like in a word or in a minute, where you could actually either throw it into a chat or raise your hand and bring up sort of how ideas to start this conversation if you have thoughts on it. Just let's take a minute and realize that we're just setting up the conversation here. Any thoughts on what would be most helpful? Jim, and then Gary.
Go ahead. I want to see brainstorming first. It's the easiest to get into. The others are almost intimidatingly complex that we should deal with after we brainstorm. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for being quick on that. And Gary, how about you? Just again, how are we starting the conversation?
I think it's very important for any project, and this is a huge one, that we clearly establish our goals. And I don't think that that's been specifically done in relation to the various aspects of this project.
Uh-huh. And you can see that Mariana is recording that as another topic. It's interrelated, but thank you. We definitely want to capture that. And other SHAC members, ideas about how it's most helpful to start this conversation on PMAs in October. Sheree?
I was just going to say, if you could send out a list of what other GSPs have put forward, just for us to kind of keep in the back of our minds as we do goal setting and brainstorming, that would be helpful. I don't know that it needs to be a specific topic of conversation, but just some information for all of us to have.
Right. In advance, a reference document to sort of see, get your thoughts rolling. And that may be a really efficient way to do that. Thank you. Greg?
Yes, I'd like to see what other people have come up with in other parts of the state included in this process, so we can take a look at what they've come up with also. Also, I would like to make sure that we stay within the boundaries of what we're charged with in the SGMA process.
Thank you, Greg. We'll record that under as a reminder under other topics. And Samantha.
I would, in the discussion of brainstorming, I'd like to have a background information of what our budget is and a reminder of that when we're talking about potential projects. And then I was hoping when we're talking about projects, we could have a little more explanation about the management areas that are described in the conceptual model, more specifically the Vina North, Vina Chico, Vina South, and then how those, what those management areas are for and who administers them and how they're gonna be used in modeling. So.
Yes. Okay, thank you. We're capturing that under other topics, again, as an important reference and context. Thanks, Samantha. Okay, any other SHAC members who've yet to weigh in, any quick ideas about how you want to begin diving into this PMA discussion? And we'll continue to build out this, what's called a Moreau board. We think it really helps with visualization, and because we're relegated to an online experience, we want to try to bring more dynamic tools into the experience for you. So thank you for your openness to our experimentation, and we'd love to get feedback as we continue to use these tools. Any other thoughts from SHAC members or the public about entering into the PMA discussion and how to tee that up for October? Okay, well, we are right at noon, and as you know from the SHAC charter, if you would like to include any future agenda topics, please do send those to me, and we'll make sure that they get to the management committee. I think we'll leave that like that. And we again, for transparency, always include correspondence as an informational item. Any correspondence that's coming to related to the SHAC, and you received that documentation. Just want to do a quick poll before we wrap it up today. So if you could go ahead and please rate your meeting experience overall. Today, was that excellent, informative and engaging meeting? Good, pretty solid meeting experience. Could have been better, or yikes, that was rough. So give us a sense of how this online experience was for you. And there are three questions. You could also let us know what you found most useful about the meeting and what you found most challenging about the meeting. Okay, please go ahead and fill that out. And we'll just take a minute and then we will adjourn. Okay, we've got a good snapshot. Anyone else want to weigh in here before I end the poll? I'm going to give you 15 more seconds to weigh in. And then we'll go ahead and wrap it up. Okay, I'm going to end the poll there. And you can see the results. Most people felt like it was a solid meeting experience. What was most useful about the meeting was we have a little bit of everything, mostly the presentations on the basin setting, the discussions, and maybe that correlates with the all of the above. And overall, there wasn't anything particularly challenging about the meeting, except I do know that a couple of you, and we were experiencing that, trying to help you through it, did have technology problems. So to the degree that we can help you work those things out before the meeting, do let us know. I appreciate you weighing in. It's always important for us to get feedback. And I also value that you were able to stay 4 minutes over, and we apologize for not meeting on time. We look forward to reaching out to you in between the meetings as we usually do, and get the meeting notes to you, and hope you all will stay safe given the fires and everything else that is going on. So with that, thanks again, and have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, everyone. Take care. Thanks, Tanya.
Thanks.
Thanks, Tanya. Christina. And Christina, and everybody.
Thank you, Linda.
Great meeting, you guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly.
Mariana, you can go ahead and stop recording.